I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello. I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to this Valet episode of the Stages podcast. Today we remember arts historian Frank Van Straten, who passed away in April. Frank was the inaugural archivist at the Performing Arts Museum, now Australian Performing Arts Collection at Arts Centre Melbourne, and later its founding director. Renowned as a theatre historian of vast knowledge, Frank was the author of many publications which celebrated theatres, artists, practitioners and productions. His historical perspectives of plays and musicals were a regular feature of programs for commercial producers. I'm so grateful that he agreed to a conversation for the Stages podcast. He was a gentleman of the theatre who I very much admired, and we recorded this conversation for Series 1 of the podcast in 2018. Like everyone, I am deeply saddened by the passing of dear Frank. What a cultural institution he became with his collection of publications, his endless anecdote, his command of our history, and his tireless support of creatives and artists. Born in London in 1936, today, May 14th, would have been Frank's 88th birthday. Valet Frank Van Straten, a true champion of the performing arts in Australia.
Yes, I do. I can picture it in my memory as if it were yesterday. It was White Horse Inn at Her Majesty's Theatre, and my parents thought it would be a good show to introduce me to live theatre. And it was. I was just entranced from the moment it started until it finished. And I came home and made a little set model of the with the revolving stage and so on, and ironically, that Madge was the first theatre that I visited, Her Majesty's here in Melbourne, and it's the subject of the current book project, A History of Her Majesty's. So it's been part of my life. Ever since I suppose, must have been about seven, that experience. And after that, my parents took me to pantomimes. That was an annual feature of family entertainment. In Melbourne, the pantomimes were at Christmas, and in Sydney, they were at Easter. The show used to travel up. And Melbourne had pantomimes at Her Majesty's, which were somewhat more decorous than the pantomimes of the Tivoli, which were rough and tumble. And I think I liked the Tivoli ones a bit more.
Because they're rough and tumble.
There was much more audience participation, and they used to throw mini violet crumbles out into the audience, and there was always a chance to, cheer the hero and hiss the villain and join in the chorus and so on. And I can remember particularly a wonderful principal boy, Jenny Howard. She was an English comedian, and She excelled in principal boy roles. And once you got over that strange British tradition that the leading man was played by a woman and the leading female comic role was played by a man, those shows were just magic. And they had armies of kids in them as well as adults. And I always sort of secretly thought I would love to have been one of those kids because they all seem to have such a wonderful time.
I thought you were going to say a panto dame for a minute there. But, of course, that convention of the dame feeds into a lot of contemporary work. I mean, you think of Hairspray and Edna Turnblatt and certainly Tim Minchin's Matilda.
Yeah, where Miss Trunchbull. Like Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Yes, indeed.
A typical dame role, actually. Yeah.
And I guess you could even cite people like Barry Humphries with Dame Edna Everidge and Artie Jack.
Yep.
As borrowing from that tradition.
Yeah, very much so, very much so.
So what was it about live performance that ignited the passion which was to steer the rest of your life, do you think?
In a funny way, I think, Peter, it was basically, I suppose, it was my parents encouraging me. My dad had been a musician in an earlier life, and he knew a lot about live theatre, and he knew a lot about popular music. And that was all sort of part of the tradition I grew up with at home. But the whole concept of live theatre, I loved the buildings, I loved the traditions, and I loved the ephemeral nature of it, the fact that you were there for this special occasion, it was being presented just for the moment, and you knew that there was no way to recapture that moment. That was it. And I also knew I was never, ever going to be a performer because I was inherently very, very shy. And I suppose being interested in the way shows were put together, who put them together, who was in them, the venues they were performing, was a vicarious way of being part of it without actually being up on the stage doing it. And in Melbourne, we're particularly lucky to have a inventory of very fine historic theatres. I mean, you can't go into Her Majesty's without somehow sensing that this is where Melba sang, where Pavlova danced, Fontaine's been there, the Borovetsky Ballet, all the great
music. All those ghosts.
Yeah, they're all there. They're all, and of course, the princess has got its own real ghost. Well, as good a authentic a ghost as you could wish. And I've spoken to many, many theatre people who've experienced the ghost. I never have, but I'm sure the people that have been really, really moved by Federici.
Was he an actor that performed at the Princess?
He was he was born in Italy, and he used the name Federici, but he was actually from an English family, and he made his name in Britain in Gilbert and Sullivan, and he came out here as a Gilbert and Sullivan performer in the late 19th century. And he made his debut here in Gilbert and Sullivan. And he actually sang one performance of the Mikado at Her Majesty's, but he mainly appeared at the Princess. And to extend his repertoire, he got himself cast as Mephistopheles in Faust. And it was a notorious enterprise, that Faust, because Nellie Stewart, who had made her name in light opera, she was given the chance to sing Margherita. And they gave Federici the chance to sing Mephistopheles. And they programmed it as they would have an operetta. It was not every other night or every third night, it was every night. And it was on the very first night that poor old Fred stood on the trapdoor to go down to the nether regions and had a heart attack on the way and was dying when the stagehands got him out of the trapdoor mechanism. And it was ill luck for poor old Nellie because she ruined her singing voice by singing Margarita, I think, on 10 or 12 successive nights.
Right.
So she never sang in opera and very little in operetta after that, and concentrated on plays. But no, Federici is commemorated. It's still in the...
There's a bar there, isn't there?
The bar, princess. Yeah.
Yes, I suspected the ghost would have had to have perhaps passed away on site. So yeah, that's solved that
for me. Yeah.
So were you? Did you grow up in Melbourne? Were you born in Melbourne?
No, I was born in London.
Right.
But I grew up in Melbourne.
Right. Yeah. So what brought Mum and Dad out to Australia?
My mother was Australian.
Oh, okay, right.
And Dad was born in the Netherlands and grew up in England. And as soon as war broke out, they decided the best thing to do is a family tradition to get out of trouble as soon as possible was to come back to Australia. Dad had met my mother when he had come out here previously as a musician, and they got married in London. And I went back to London with them in 1948, first of the trips I made back to London, yeah.
Did you have any collections as a child? Was there anything that you collected that was to do with the performing arts, or did you have a stamp collection?
It's funny you ask that, Peter, because my father was a philatelist. He loved stamp collecting, and he was like a senior member of the stamp collecting fraternity, and he tried to interest me in stamps. And the stamps he collected were what were called imperforates of the British Empire. They were the sort of stamps that were issued before they introduced perforations.
Right, okay.
You would buy a sheet of these stamps and you'd cut them up to use them and paste them on.
You'd have to paste them on with glue, I guess, yes.
And to me, they were the dullest, most ugliest little bits of paper you could imagine, and I didn't want anything to do with them at all. But I did pick up Dad's interest in printing. He developed a great knowledge of printing through his stamp collecting, and I then became interested in the printing and in the printing of theatre programs. So I started collecting every program from every show I saw. And we had a little circle of friends who used to also go to theatre and saw shows that I hadn't seen, and they would hand the programme on to me. So this started to build up. And then one dear lady passed away, and she had told her heirs that her programme collection should go to Frank. And it did, and there were these beautiful programs from the 20s and the 30s, and with lovely coloured covers, because the era I'm talking about when I started collecting was like the war, post-war, where printing was fairly basic.
Yes.
Usually like one colour programs and on cheap paper. But these were beautiful. I thought, well, this is nice. So I started collecting backwards as well as contemporary stuff. And I've got a huge collection now.
And of course you went on to be the star of many a theatre programme as well, with your biography of the show or the performers within it, giving a bit of a historical perspective to any big commercial musical that you might have seen.
That happened when I was at the Arts Centre, and there was the Arts Centre co-produced a...
Was it the summer musicals that they did?
I can't remember whether it was a summer musical or not, but it was HMS Pinafore. And that had...
With Paul Eddington, wasn't it?
The Eddington one. And that had particular resonance for Australia because Williamson, J.C. Williamson, his theatrical empire was built on the success of his production of HMS Pinafore in the Gilbert and Sullivan repertoire. So I was asked would I write notes for that program, which I did. And it sort of rolled on from there. I think I've written program notes for something like 150, 200 different shows. And the funny thing is, I get asked now, can we reuse your notes? And so I have to go back and update them occasionally. And I did the production company notes for years and years, and now they're recycling some of their shows and recycling my notes.
Well, they're terrific historical documents, vital historical documents.
It became a bit of a sort of tradition that Frank will do the notes, mainly for musicals, but I've done others as well, and for some concerts and CD inserts and things like that. But I love doing them, and I love the research, and I love bringing out the Australian connections. Which used to be so often ignored or forgotten.
Well, I hope they got you a seat at the performance.
Oh, usually. Usually. I enjoy writing, and one of my first jobs was in advertising, or some of my first jobs were in advertising, where I used to write advertising copy and also write material for house magazines for different companies. And so I loved the whole writing thing. And then there was an organisation down here called the National Theatre, and that was being run by John Carger, who's well known as an ABC broadcaster, but he was the administrator of the National Theatre down here, which is a school of drama, a school of dance, and originally a school of opera, operating out of the old Victory Theatre, National Theatre now in St Kilda. And John rang me one day and said, look, I've got a room full of all the historic records of the National Theatre that go right back to when it was founded in 1935. He said, I want to get rid of them. Will you take them for the Performing Arts Museum in Melbourne? So I said, yes, love to. One of the last things John did before he retired was to say he would love to have that material used as a basis for a story, for a book about the history of the National Theatre Movement. And about that time I was thinking of retiring from the Arts Centre, and I had a visit from a rather Harris lady who had been appointed head of what was called the Victoria Press. The Victoria Press was an attempt to commercialise the government department in Victoria that printed Hansard. And they had all this equipment, they had editors and they had typesetters, the whole thing, and it was not being fully used, so they were told, see if you can put it on a commercial basis. We suggested a book to commemorate, I can't remember what anniversary it was, of the Beatles visit, because we had a fantastic archive on the Beatles. And we put that together, and it was called A Special Magic or something, and it was a great success. And they got patted on the back, and the next thing, what can we do next? So I thought to myself, well, there's this National Theatre book. And I suggested that to them. And I think if I'd have suggested reprinting the 1893 telephone directory, they would have jumped at it. But they said, yes, well, we would love to do that. So I went ahead and wrote, and we put together a really sort of useful little book about the history of the National Theatre. Well, it gave me a purpose in life after having left the Arts Centre. And extraordinarily, Peter, I don't know how it's happened, but I've never had to sort of really hawk a manuscript around ever since. People sort of come to me and say, can you do a book on this? Can you do a book on that? So,
tapping into that vast knowledge and passion that you have, I mean, I first encountered you and the vast knowledge that you impart on all of us through Clive Stark's
ABC Sunday morning program. I used to tune in every week, and I garnered a lot of knowledge from that. So I have to thank you for that. But you were then at the Victorian Arts Centre Performing Arts Museum. Let's talk about the Arts Centre. Did the museum, was that founded at the same time as the Arts Centre, or did it come along a little bit later?
It's a fascinating story, and it goes back to Clive Stark, as you mentioned. He had this arts program on a Sunday morning, and he had as a guest one morning a lady called Viola Tate, Lady Tate. She was the widow of Sir Frank Tate, who had been the managing director of J.C. Williamson's, and she was passionately interested in theatre history. And during this interview with Clive Stark, she said she would love to see a theatre museum in Melbourne. She said, oh, it's all this wonderful J.C. Williamson material sitting in storerooms. It all needs to be available for research and display. And if only there were somewhere where it could go.
So there's nothing at all that existed to
nothing
to
at all
destroy our history.
And she had written a very important book on Australian theatre history called A Family of Brothers, about how the Tate brothers, including her late husband, had virtually dominated live theatre in Australia for decades. And somehow or other, she must have talked to George Fairfax, who was the project officer for the development of an arts centre here in Melbourne. He'd been overseas and with a man called Bill Akers, who was a production manager and a great mover and shaker in the arts world. He'd grown up as a... he was originally a dancer, and then he grew up in the Borovansky Ballet years and so on. And they went overseas looking for ideas for art centres, and they saw that some of the great art centres overseas had material on display in their foyers and so on. And George had this thing, he didn't want his foyers, to quote him, full of dead people's things. he saw a place for a special gallery, as it were, devoted to displaying memorabilia from the past. And so the idea of a performing arts museum was developed, and they appointed a committee to advise on it, and Lady Tate was on that committee. And so when it became apparent that the government agreed to this being part of the Arts Centre, they got, it was funded as a special item in the Arts Centre's budget. But it meant that if the Arts Centre went down the drain, the museum was still...
It would be preserved.
It had its own budget, which was a very, very good thing.
And that's a very forward-thinking government of the time to allow that, yeah.
This little committee organised a display to sort of launch the concept, and it was in the foyer of the National Gallery here in Melbourne, and one of the highlights was a costume that had belonged to Dame Nellie Melba. And Lady Tate knew Melba's granddaughter, who lent this costume, and they went up to Coombe Cottage to collect it, she and Bill Akers. Melba's granddaughter, Lady Vesty, had lent costumes to the Sydney Opera House for a display up there. And she had a great deal of trouble getting them back. So she went up to Sydney and said, I want my grandmother's costumes back, please. And they just sort of bundled them in a box and said, here you are. And she was absolutely disgusted. Now, Bill Akers, having grown up in the ballet world, knew how to treat costumes, and he took a special box up to Coombe Cottage. He didn't know anything about this background. So there's this cloak that Melba had worn in Lohengrin. It's this magnificent thing. And he folded it it had tissue paper and it folded it so beautifully. Lady Vesty was so impressed and she said, I want to think about it a bit, but why don't you take the whole collection? So eventually that entire wardrobe came down for preservation at the Art Centre. And that was the first major gift to the emerging museum. And the next thing that happened was that Lady Tate used her influence to get all the Williamson archives in Melbourne across to the Art Centre for preservation. And then they decided they'd better put on some staff to look after this material. So I put a tiny little advertisement in The Age for a curator for an arts, performing arts museum. And I saw this and I was sort of between books and...
Were you in advertising at the time?
No. I'd had a couple of other subsequent careers.
Right.
And I saw this little ad and I thought, that sounds interesting. And then I thought, oh, no, forget it. Just. And a friend said, no, go for it, go see what happens. So I applied. And I had absolutely no qualifications in running a museum, which in a funny way was perhaps a bit of an advantage, because I went for the first interview. It was like a panel interview with George Fairfax and his 2IC and Eric Westbrook, who was head of the National Gallery. Went quite well, and as I was being shown out, George's 2IC said, oh, that was quite a good interview. He said, one thing I meant to ask you, he said, somebody mentioned something about a murder in a Melbourne theatre. He said, do you know anything about that? And I said, started to burble on. It was called the Greer Tragedy, and it was in the old Academy of Music in Bourke Street, jealous husband, the whole thing. I'd sort of burbled this. Oh, yes, that'd be it. Oh, thanks very much. We'll let you know. And then I was called back for a second interview. And what I didn't realise, Peter, was that they asked that question of every applicant, and I was the only one that knew.
As a test, just to see how vast the knowledge was. Oh, brilliant.
So I came back for the second interview, and at the end of that interview, this guy, 2IC, said, you did very well. He said, we'll let you know as soon as we can. One thing I forgot to ask you, he said, the public speaking, does that any problems for you? And I said, no, that'd be fine. So I walked home and I thought to myself, Christ. One thing that I was absolutely, totally scared of was public speaking.
Well, you talk about being a shy kid. I mean, that followed you through your young adulthood.
So yeah. I thought, well, when I get home, I better phone him and say, look, just cross me off the list. Instead, the phone rang as soon as I got in the door. I answered, it was Martin. He said, I've got some good news and some bad news. And I said, well, you know, what? Give me the bad news first. And he said, it's between you and another person. He said, it's come down to that. And I said, oh, all right. He said, now do you want the good news? And I said, yes. He said, well, this person can't start until for the next 3 months. If you can hold off till then, we'll have enough money left in the budget to pay both of you if you can work together. So I said, oh, that sounds very good. And it turned out this guy had been a school teacher. And I thought, well, there's the public speaking taken care of. He can do all that. And it turned out that we got on very well. Martin took us both to lunch, and it was like we've been friends for years. And so Ron was the first director, and I was the first curator. And we got on really well right from the start. Looking back on it, it was George Fairfax cast the staff for the Art Centre like he was going to cast a play. Didn't matter whether you had any qualifications, formal qualifications or not. If you thought, Peter, no, you could do that. You could look after that part. And Mary that we saw this morning, she'd be good in that. And she'd work with Peter. And And it worked.
Very clever, yeah.
Yeah, it was terrific. And the excitement and the dedication to get that place built and open, because it was still just holes in the ground at that stage. The whole concept of the museum, it was so vague that we were given the privilege to create it as we wanted it to be. We weren't given a project and said, run it. The whole thing was our creation. And it worked. And we got the place open, up and running. And then poor old Ron had a heart attack and virtually died on the job.
Right.
I was in Sydney at the time, and Martin rang me and told me, and he said, you better come back to Melbourne as soon as you can. So I did. And again, it was George. There was sort of, I don't think there was any formal advertising for a replacement. I was just...
You'd have got it.
Yeah, just shoved in Frankel there. And that's how all that happened. But it was through that I started broadcasting, because we put together a spectacular exhibition on the history of radio.
That was the first exhibition for
the... No, that wasn't. No? The first one was Melba.
Right.
Which was a beautiful exhibition designed by Anne Fraser, who was a well-known Melbourne designer. And I learned a lesson from that. She sort of summed me up from the start, and I was sort of making what I thought were helpful suggestions about, you know, what... She said, you'd like to be designing this yourself, wouldn't you? And I thought to myself, yeah, that's a pretty good hint. Just shut up, hold your tongue, and let people do what they know how to do. But that was the first exhibition. The second major one was called Bourke Street on Saturday Night, which celebrated the old days of Bourke Street, when virtually all Melbourne's live entertainment was centred in and around Bourke Street. We developed this concept of having four major exhibitions a year and four smaller ones. So that there would, even when we were changing the major ones over, there'd be a smaller one to see if you visited the museum. And so that meant we were mounting eight exhibitions a year, which was a hell of a lot.
And this was an exhibition space within the Arts Centre?
Yeah. At the back of what was then a concert hall, the Haber Hall. It was even so vague in the early days, but I remember walking with Ron and George around the place, saying, would this work for an exhibition space? Anyway, the place we were given was really a very difficult space to work with, but we devised a way of working around the columns and the awkward shape. And it was, looking back on it, back in to about 1980, it was all, the equipment and so on, was all fairly unsophisticated. And we wanted lighting effects, we wanted sound effects and so on. And I can remember almost a schoolboy coming in, and he had a couple of ideas of how he could construct a tape deck that would give us the sound and would somehow trigger the lights. We were using cassette tapes. That's how primitive it all was. You know?
Because that would be an essential part of the exhibition to create some atmosphere.
Yeah. And he came up with this sort of Heath Robinson thing, and he was brilliant. And if anything went wrong, he'd be there in a flash, and he would fix it. And he would slowly... Technical things improved. He'd updated. And that guy is now running the Lyric Theatre and the Capitol Theatre in Sydney, Stephen Found.
Oh, wow.
And that's how he got his start.
Yeah.
And we were able to sort of trigger quite a lot of careers through people working with us in the museum. And we pioneered a lot of display techniques that are sort of taken for granted now.
Yeah.
And I still get people saying, you know, I got turned on to the performing arts by seeing such and such an exhibition.
Well, did it take long to capture the public's imagination and get them along to the exhibitions?
The hard thing was to get them to get noticed, because we were in a fairly tucked away position. It wasn't ideal from an access point of view, but the word of mouth was very important. And at the drop of a hat, I used to get on air and talk about what we were doing and so on. And it was the radio exhibition that we did that the publicity manager of the Art Centre arranged for me to go into Clive Stark's programme. No, sorry, not Clive Stark. There was a guy called John Cook, who had the evening programme on ABC local radio. And he said, take a few tapes in of old radio programmes and talk about them. And it was supposed to be a 20-minute spot. And John was absolutely captivated by it. It turned out that I was on air for the whole hour. And it was being produced by a wonderful man called Peter Jeppesen. And Peter had been a news producer. News and Current Affairs was his lifeblood. And he'd done something he shouldn't have done, and he'd been banished to do John Cook's programme as a punishment for a month or so. And as I was leaving, he said, oh, that was quite good. He said, would you have enough for another program next week? So I said, yeah, of course. So I went in and did it again the following week. And then he said, well, what about next week? Was he have enough for that? And so I went in. And while he was producing it, I went in every week. And he'd always ask me, have you got enough stuff for next week? He never could really grasp what this whole sort of nostalgia thing was. It wasn't Current Affairs. And then poor old John blotted his copybook. He got taken off air, and there was a big reshuffle, and I got switched to the Sunday mornings with Clive Stark, and that became part of the furniture at 774.
How long did you do that for?
I think 13, 15 years. Wow. A long time. And Clive was wonderful to work with, and we developed, you know, quite a close friendship. And that program was, if the football was on, it was half an hour, and if there's no football, it was an hour. And the programs I liked best were the ones where we had in-studio guests. And sometimes they took off, and very occasionally they didn't. But we broke a few barriers with that. And I remember Lady Vesty, who I mentioned before, Millwall's granddaughter, she had written a book about her mother, her grandmother, and she asked me to launch it up at the Athenaeum Theatre in Lilydale. So I very, very brazenly said, look, I would be privileged to do that, but on one condition. And she said, what's that? I said, that you would be my guest on the radio program. And I mean, she was a terribly shy lady, much shyer than I'd ever been. I think. And she said, look, I wouldn't do it for anybody else, I'd do it for you. So I launched the book, and she came down to do the Sunday morning live. In this, and you think she was going to have all the teeth extracted. She sat there, and Melba's recordings had recently been cleaned up digitally and sounding better than they'd ever sounded before. And she had the headphones on sitting like this. And as soon as we played the first track, her face changed and she was in awe. She'd never heard a grandmother sing like that before. Wow. And she started to unwind. And it was just magic, some absolute magic seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But we had some funny guests as well. There was one extraordinary lady, and I can't remember her name, and probably better I don't, who developed an act imitating Mae West. she was appearing at a cabaret here in Melbourne, and they contacted me and said, you know, would you like to have her as a guest? Because she knows all about Mae West, and she's very, very good. I said, yeah, that sounds just the sort of thing we can build a program on. Then the publicist said, do you want her to be as herself, or do you want her to be as Mae West? I said, look, it's entirely up to her. If she wants to do the voice, it's like if you have Barry Humphries.
Yes, do you want Edna or Barry? Yeah.
And I said, it's entirely up to her. And I had some Mae West tracks ready and all that. I always found, Peter, that if we had a guest, and the earlier they got to the studio, the more nervous they were.
Right.
I had Robin Archer as a guest once, and she arrived probably 20 seconds before she was due to go on air, and she was fine. I got to the studio for this Mae West lady. Man at the door said to me, go and have a look in the cafe, you won't believe what's there. And there she was, dressed as Mae West, sitting there having a cup of tea. She looked wonderful. And we got her on air, and she was extraordinary. And people couldn't believe they weren't listening to an old interview that I'd somehow...
So you interviewed her as Mae West, of course. Yeah.
And she was absolutely delightful. Well, that went along to the show a couple of nights later, and on stage she was dreadful.
Oh, really?
She was totally different.
Yeah.
And it's just, there was a bit of a lesson in all that. Yeah. But those nostalgia shows, people still remember them with a lot of affection. I particularly remember Clive because he was so good to work with.
It was a great show.
Yeah.
You talk about Melba's granddaughter willingly donating her grandmother's costumes. Mm. Did you have to go searching for pieces to be donated, or did it quickly word get around that this was the place that I can safely leave?
Yeah, I think that's what happened, Peter. Part of it was that we had a very, very small acquisitions budget, and it was only at the last resort that we actually had to buy things. Mainly they were donated, and the collection is absolutely huge now, and it's a great testament to the generosity of people and the trust they had that things would be properly looked after.
Well, you've got everything. Barry Humphries has donated Edna costumes, and Kylie Minogue has donated stuff.
Extraordinary. I was actually in Canberra, and I took a call from a gentleman. He said, oh, my name's Minogue. He said, my daughter's a singer. And that's how the Minogue thing started.
Fantastic.
It really is. But the Humphries thing too, that without denigrating Barry's generosity, he had a substantial storage bill for some costumes that he hadn't needed for some time that were in Sydney. And
right.
It seemed, I think, initially a good way to solve the storage problem.
Yeah.
And since then he donated stacks and stacks of costumes and memorabilia, including some wonderful recordings. He used to have his shows recorded professionally, so he could listen and analyse what he'd done and the audience reaction. And on those, you could hear him warming up before he went on stage. He'd be like, I'm going to get the buggers, I'm going to get that plane. And he'd put on the different voices and suck himself into going to grab that audience.
That's precious knowledge.
Yeah.
That's great.
Wonderful stuff. Yeah. Absolutely wonderful.
What about you and your collection? What's your prized theatrical memorabilia that you actually own? Because I look around this magnificent home of yours, and there's costume designs all over the walls.
Yeah.
I see one that I think that's Jill Perriman and Hello Dolly.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's South Pacific there, Bloody Mary. Yeah.
I don't.
Or is it there too many to choose from?
I think there are probably too many to choose from. That's a very odd question. I've never really thought about it. I never really, I think, had a favourite piece. But
I just thought you might have had Noel Coward's pen or...
I've got a little...
Tangelly Melba's gargle glass.
I've got a little painting by Noel Coward.
All right, yeah.
Which I treasure.
Yeah.
And I've got another painting by Borovansky of his own.
Wow.
I love those. But no, I don't know. No.
The costume designs all around the wall, etc. They're gifts from the designers, obviously, or the producers, or
no, or some of them are. Louis Kahan was very generous to me. I've got quite a number of his, and Bill Constable. Bill designed most of the Borovansky ballets and a lot of films in Britain that have since become cult classics. He gave me in the sunroom their beautiful design for an Noel Coward ballet called London Morning that he did, and he was a total character, Bill Constable, a sort of very lovable larrikin, a great designer. But the funny thing about that London Morning design was that I knew about Noel Coward's writing this score, and it was issued on a 10-inch microgroove record with Bill's set design reproduced on the cover.
Wow.
And Bill was over here one day, and I said, look where I put your design. He's looking at it, and I thought, I said to him, of course, you know, it's on the recording, cover of the recording. He said, no. So I draped it out and showed him. Oh, he said, I never got my permission. He said, I'll sue the lot of them. And I don't know whether he ever did or not.
The back royalties.
But yeah, that it's a stunning design. The thing with the costume designs, I don't know what the market's like now, but when I first started, you could get costume designs for almost peanuts. There was just one guy in Sydney that specialised in them, but they didn't sort of reach the market. Designers kept them.
Yes.
With the set designs always seemed to stay with the companies, and the costume designs was stayed with the designer. Whether that's still the case or not, I don't know. But at one stage, we had an exhibition about costume design at the Performing Arts Museum, and I had the idea of asking Melbourne designers to give us a selection of their designs if they wanted to sell them. So we had them on display in the foyer, and probably about 60 or 70 beautiful designs, and they weren't expensive, but people didn't buy them.
Really?
No, I don't think there's much of a market for them.
Because they are quite unique works of art, aren't they?
Yeah.
The detail in some of them, and the exhibition of character.
One of my most exciting experiences was working with Graham Murphy.
Yeah.
When he did the Tivoli Ballet, and I was historical advisor on that, it's great. And Christian Fredrickson, he designed that ballet, beautifully designed, and Graham and he gave me four of the designs from that, which I treasure. But no, the whole costume design thing, it's really, really interesting, and the art of transferring something like that to
something you wear.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. And some of the designs are so just conceptual without much detail. You wonder how they get translated to the physical.
And we talked earlier about the ghosts of the theatre which exist in there, and you can feel the performers of the past that have been there. But these costume designs, often drawn with a similar image to the actor that's going to wear the costume, certainly sort of reek of ghosts as well, don't they?
Yeah.
As well as, you know, finding an old costume that somebody wore. I mean, you talk about the Melba costume. Is extraordinary. It's that, not 6 degrees of separation, it's sort of, you know, I'm actually touching a garment that the great Melba wore.
Well, I think you could still go to a costume hire house here in Melbourne and hire costumes from the old Williamson collection that have got names like Perriman and Hayes and stuck inside the neck, you know?
Yeah.
And they're still in use, but there is a... I think the other problem with the actual costumes is that a lot of them are so bulky.
Yes.
They take so much space to store, and they're a real challenge for preservation.
But well, hopefully there's a bit of longevity about them also, because they were built to sort of play 8 performances a week, often for, you know, you think about that original My Fair Lady, 3 years or so in Australia.
Yeah.
The detail's extraordinary. We talked earlier about the National Theatre book, Story of Gertrude Johnson and the National Theatre. You've written a number of books. How long does a book take you to write? Because there must be a lot of, you know, merging yourself in all of that research and contemplation. And
everyone's a journey and an adventure. And it, to me, the whole exploring history has changed so radically. When I started, there was virtually no internet.
Yes.
And now, I reckon in future, you'd be able to tell if a book was researched before Trove and the internet or after, because it's open so much, so readily, and it's all there, the touch of a keypad, you can read a review from 1908 or something like that, and it's changed the whole business of research. And I love the digging, and I love the finding the little odd asides, the little things that perhaps had seemed unimportant, but with the passage of time you can give them some context.
You're like an archaeologist, aren't you?
Yeah, it's
finding
true.
Those little diamonds that...
And it feeds into my knowledge and love of printing too. I mean, you could show me 2 programs side by side and I could tell you that's the Melbourne one and that's the Sydney one, just by looking at
the font,
the printing. And the other thing which is in theatre history I find fascinating are the advertisements in the programs. Not so much now, but in earlier days you could tell what the audience was like from the products being advertised in the program. And for instance, the Tivoli ones would have ads for money lenders and bars and billiard saloons, whereas the Williamson ones might have ads for expensive cars or smart furnishings or fashions, you know. They were appealing to different audiences, and I just find that...
They're great historical and social, cultural documents.
Oh, yeah.
That tell us a lot.
Yeah. And the other thing which I find really extraordinary looking at programs now and compared to programs then, if you look at a program from the 1950s, it'll have produced by, meaning directed by, it'll have scenery by, because the scenic artist was the designer. It wasn't 2 people. And it would probably have who made the costumes, and very little else. Now you look in the back of a program, there's an army of names and jobs and positions, and it is quite extraordinary. Think, God, did all those people have to be employed to get this thing on the stage? I just find it mind-boggling.
Well, that's right. It does give you an indication of how many in the village it takes to put on a show.
Yeah. But well, I just assume that in the 19, in the earlier years, it didn't need that many people. I mean, I suppose the productions were nowhere near as sophisticated as they are now, but it's...
Now you've got all those people that deal with marketing, I suppose, and social media and...
And in the case of the subsidised companies raising the money.
They all need to be acknowledged.
Yeah, I know.
So your book on the Regent Theatre at the moment, that's going along well? Not the Regent, I beg your pardon, Majesty's.
Majesty's, Royal Theatre, yeah. Yes, it is. It's it was commissioned by Mike Walsh. I don't think he knew what he was letting himself or me in for.
Because Mike owns the theatre now.
He owns the theatre, and he rescued it, really. Mm. It was due to be redeveloped as offices or a car park. The previous owners had discovered a way to make it pay with a skeleton staff of 3 and a minimum of 6 weeks' bookings a year. So it was winding down. And it was, they spent virtually nothing on technical maintenance. And it got to the stage where the fly tower was unsafe. It couldn't take a big show. And I don't know whether Mike really realised what he was taking on, but take it on he did. And thank goodness, because it's as he said, it's better than it ever was before. Mm. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful theatre. Virtually without an archive, didn't have a collection to represent the history of the plays, and Mike decided it needed its own, need to preserve its own history, and I went with him up to the Royal Historical Society, who were sorting out stuff they didn't want, including a lot of theatre programmes, and he snapped up the Madge ones. And that formed the basis, there were only about 40 of them, formed the basis of the what's now a major archive within the building, looked after by a wonderful lady called Mary Murphy. And it has expanded dramatically. And it's now a very, very valuable resource. Again, 99% of it is donated by people that have appeared at the theatre or been patrons for years and so on. And the Princess has got a similar archive. It's great.
Well, it's fantastic. Well, let me finish with a question which is probably quite obvious, but why is it important to preserve our entertainment history?
Why is it important? To me, I mean, it's important to preserve all our history, I suppose, but there's something... I think entertainment says so much about us as a people that by preserving the history of entertainment, you're preserving a substantial slice of our own social history. And you can see so many changes in perspective, in attitude over the years reflected in entertainment and what people went to see and what how they reacted to it. I love all that. And the physical remnants of it, all the programs, the costumes, the designs, even the play scripts and so on, they tell you so much that I just treasure all that. And I just wanted people to feed off it and enjoy it. I suppose I haven't put that at all well.
No, no, I think that's perfect.
It's just something that is inherent in me. I've always been as interested in the past as I am in the future, and I've been around such a long time. I've seen so many changes, and to realise how things have evolved, and the things that have stayed the same. To me, that's It's so much of a reward, and I just love the dedication of people in the performing arts. And the one thing that's come out of the Majesty's book is the number of sad stories there are, performers that have fallen by the wayside, died too early, died in obscurity, come to unfortunate ends. And if what I do can in some way compensate for the dramas of their lives, then I think that's worthwhile. And the other thing is, if the little stories, the little asides, all that encourages somebody to think, oh, what fun, a bit more about that.
Go person. Down that rabbit hole of investigation.
And that person, by doing that, can get as much of a thrill as I do by doing the initial dig, then I think that's well worth the effort.